Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode von Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und ich habe mich hier in Austin im Rahmen der South by Southwest mit Dr. Ruman Chowdhury getroffen. Sie ist eine der führenden Expertinnen für KI-Ethik und hat über Jahre hinweg an der Schnittstelle von Technologie, Verantwortung und Regulierung gearbeitet. Ihre Arbeit zeigt, wie künstliche Intelligenz unsere Gesellschaft verändert und welche Risiken entstehen, wenn wirtschaftliche und geopolitische Interessen stärker sind als ethische Bedenken. Ich wollte von ihr wissen, warum wir zunehmend die Verantwortung für KI-Entscheidungen aus der Hand geben, welche Rolle Staaten und Konzerne in der Entwicklung spielen und ob wir die Kontrolle über unsere eigenen Technologien verlieren. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Ruman, I'm so happy to meet you here at South by Southwest. You've just been on stage talking about AI, and we will talk about that a little bit further here. So welcome.
Thank you so much.
The last couple of days, there have been a lot of discussions about AI here at South by Southwest. People talked about superhuman intelligence. People talked about rebuilding organic brains to run tech systems on it. We've seen a lot here. What do you think, if you look at your experience and everything you see out there right now, what would you say are the biggest misconceptions and misunderstandings when it comes to AI right now?
I think the big thing that is misunderstood is people think it is this magical, mystical object rather than a technological product. It has been built. It is an impressive tool and product that has been built. But it is simply that. It's not alive. It's not, it has no intent or understanding. I think a lot of this conversation around the fears of AI presume things like intent, which a technology doesn't have. And in doing so, we erase the fact that human beings are the ones imbuing the intent, whether by how they build it or what they use it for.
But if we look at, we also had a lot of talks about the age of operators and agents in AI. If we look at that, I could assume that this AI at least has the intent to learn and understand a task on its own, that like the initial task was given by a human, but then those agents and operators at least try to solve it with whatever they can find.
It's executing the task that it's been given. It doesn't want to do, it doesn't want anything, right? So that's not intent, it is executing on its program. So somebody who has built an AI agent has written a program where it states, you know, these are the tools and the websites and the things you can use and, you know, solve this problem that I can contribute to it in natural language, but then it is translated to a machine readable language and then it executes on a command. So it is no different from literally a computer system executing on a command. It is just doing it with a wide range of resources.
If I add like one kind of science fiction question to that, do you think we would be able to create an AI system, a kind of a superhuman system that is able to create its own intentions and really act independently, autonomous from humans without an input, without a task we are giving it?
We don't know where consciousness comes from, so nobody knows how to answer that question. Anybody who claims they do has a very limited understanding of what consciousness, and they're confusing access, compute, and skill with intelligence and consciousness. So there's a difference between intent and execution. So as if we grant AI systems more and more access to institutions, you know, databases, etc., it can do an increasing amount of tasks. But unless it has what's known as an objective function, a task it is set to do, which a human being has given it, it will not do anything because it doesn't want anything. So I think there is like often a lot of futurists use very loose language between capability and consciousness.
You are someone who has like a very strong track record in AI ethics and the question how we are dealing with it in the end. I have the feeling that over the last maybe 2 or 3 years, compared to like maybe 10 years ago, when I've been here for the first couple of times at South By, we had almost everywhere, like a very intense discussion, what could happen with AI and how are we dealing with it and all the ethics questions connected to that. Now I've got the feeling we've got the technology, but the discussions around AI ethics are way less than they have been before. What's your perspective on that?
I actually agree with you, and it's unfortunate to see that. I was at the Paris AI Summit about a month ago, and that's what a lot of us walked away with. There seemed to be this very accelerationist, would be the term that a lot of people use. And whether or not you fall into this existential risk camp or the responsible AI, like the ethics camp, I hope that there is a common shared understanding that no one's being listened to. Whether, like, I may not believe AI is going to set up nuclear weapons and blow things up. And, you know, maybe other people on that camp don't believe that the big thing we should be concerned about is like things like the future of work or bias and discrimination. But I think we can all agree that nobody building this technology is really taking any of it seriously anymore. And that is very concerning. It's very worrisome to see. Some of it is borne by this increasing AI arms race that's being artificially propped up. Some of it's actually just geopolitical, as we see the rise of certain government regimes becoming very protectionist about how AI is being built. And AI is increasingly tied to the state. Remember, this is a technology that is supposed to be built by private corporations. Instead, it has now become a state-owned and operated technology. We are now seeing that conversation more and more because now they're just competing geopolitically with each other. So I fully agree. And it's almost ironic because what generative AI brought to every person was the ability to see for themselves what AI can and cannot do. So we built the tools for people to be able to critically analyze AI, and yet it led to people building fewer institutions and structures to do something with that critical analysis ability.
Are we maybe just too excited and overwhelmed by what is already possible? And we are just like seeing all the tools, we want to use all of them, we want to kind of figure out what we can do with them and forget about, yeah, analyzing the consequences and what it actually means if we put all our data into a system like that and everything.
I actually wish that were the case. I actually wish that everybody was super enthusiastic and wanted to use all the AI tools and they downloaded it for themselves and they played with it themselves, right? Because then they would have a better critical understanding of what these tools mean and what they can and cannot do. That to me would be actually an ideal state. I want people to be excited, but I don't think they are excited. I think a very small set of people who are very, very well funded by venture capitalists, et cetera, are excited and they're building these tools. But 90% of the human population either is disengaged or actively concerned, but none of them feel like they can do anything about it.
You already mentioned the geopolitical aspect when it comes to AI and the arms race we are seeing. We right now, with all the, let's say, uncertainties of geopolitical changes and everything that is happening on this planet right now, we see that China is heavily investing in AI. Europe just announced that they are finally going to invest more in AI. The US is investing in AI. And at the same time, we've seen, if we look at the climate crisis and climate change and how we are tackling that or not tackling that on a global scale, we had a lot of discussion about a global AI regulation, like a common understanding, like global common understanding about how we are using it and how we are not using it. If we look at climate change and everything that we didn't achieve on a global scale, are you actually afraid of what could happen with AI when we are not able to find like a common understanding, a global common understanding on how to use it?
Yeah, I 6 months ago, I would have given you a very different answer to this question, right? I do think 2025 will be the year of sovereign AI. We will see nation states building their own large language models and image generation models, et cetera, building their own AI agents. And the reason the state has to step in is because it is very, very expensive to do. So absent, you know, billionaires funding these things, the state funds it. But as a result, then they become tools of the state. And to be clear, we were already living in a world in which increasingly technology was being used by the state. But now we're going to see, you know, AI development being owned. As a result, it will be harder to achieve global regulation because we have a massive imbalance, right? So if you're not the US or maybe China, you see yourself as needing to punch up, right? To like compete. So we won't get, it will be very difficult to get global cooperation in that kind of an environment. You know, I'm glad you brought up climate. An alternative model that existed in climate was something like the IPCC, a scientific entity that was actually, you know, getting together to understand climate issues and talk about and regulate on, not regulate, but at least push for science, like evidence-based and science-based regulation in climate. I am not sure if that will happen in AI. I know there have been a few entities set up, but we also live in a time in which science is constantly under attack, right? In which, you know, science is used as a tool of policy and ideology more than it is used as a tool of inquiry.
This weekend, I had a discussion with someone from the State Department about ICANN and how we dealt with domains on a global scale. Yep. Do you think something like that could be an option for how we handle AI?
I think there are. So I guess I'll answer your question a different way. There's like a formula by which we could achieve global cooperation around AI. Let's just call it standards or regulation. So one is we have to clearly define what it is we're regulating on or for. I think AI is just too broad. It can mean a myriad of different things. So one is, I think, surfacing the issues and questions that are truly global in nature, right? Maybe that's something like the future of work. From my perspective, actually, I don't think bias and discrimination is something that is global, a global issue to address. Actually, I think it's a local issue to address because these issues manifest themselves in very contextually specific ways, right? So first is like parsing out what's the problem that you want to solve globally, right? Second is, what are the credible institutions that can enforce? I think one thing that happens and one way that's led to failure is building a brand new organization and then trying to figure out where this organization is now supposed to fit in this already crowded geopolitical space. So now we have everyone from the United Nations to OECD to everybody else who is already an established credible organization engaging in this AI, global AI governance conversation, right? So it's a very crowded room. Who has the authority and credibility? So that'd be second, right? And the third would be, who are the people best equipped to do this? And that, I think, is the hardest one to figure out, right? Because there are, A, so few people who do this work, but B, everybody is, in a sense, compromised. And compromised maybe isn't the right word. It's just there's nobody's coming into this agnostic anymore. There's just not, that person does not exist. So then how do we create this without making it, again, a tool of ideology and policy? And I don't know if I know the answer to that, but that would be the formula, like those three steps. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You already mentioned billionaires owning AI technology and kind of empowering them with their money. But also, as you mentioned, bias, if we look at who is using AI, and the more complex AI is getting, the more expensive it is getting, the more it is used by rather high income people or big corporations. So do we already have kind of a training bias within AI because the data we are putting in are rather kind of created by higher income people or users?
So we already know where a lot of the bias in generative AI models come from. So number one is, we know a lot of the data source, like Common Crawl, Reddit, et cetera. That is, so first of all, there's a language bias, because most of the data, quote, of the internet is in English, and there is very little in other languages, which means if you are not from a country in which people natively speak English particularly well, your perspectives are not there. So that's knock out most of the global majority, right? So now we are stuck with mainly English-speaking countries. The second is, the internet is a primarily male space, right? So again, if we're thinking about Reddit, the way Reddit is, that's part of the training set. The third, which is actually interesting, one thing I was actually just reading this morning, is companies are now trying to diversify and get better data by making these, by working with different media organizations, right? But what we find is that left-wing media corporations don't allow AI companies to just use their data, and right-wing media organizations do. So now I think we're actually starting to see a partisan bias here, where, again, because the left-wing media is trying to be protectionist of their employees and not, you know, see them being exploited and that, you know, possibly leading to them, their employees not having jobs, they are unintentionally biasing the models because all the right-wing media outlets are freely giving their data and information.
Another topic I think, or I have the feeling that we are not discussing enough right now, but did discuss a lot in the past, was the impact of AI on how we work and actually who's working.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot about AI kind of stealing our jobs in the past. We talked a lot about, who is still going to work as a human if we can do a lot of stuff with AI and robotics in the end. And that whole discussion kind of also slowed down a lot. But do you think, how can we tackle that challenge? Because I think we do see that we will have a lot of today's tasks, at least, or the mm-hmm. tasks in the past. We can solve a lot of that with robotics and AI.
So I like that question because the future of work has become an abstraction versus a tangible thing we can work towards. And again, with all other world-changing technologies, including computers, there was actually an effort put in to educate people on how to use them, how to benefit from them. And I was talking about before we started recording that I just did the speaker session, like the closed speaker session with a group of people. And one of the people in the room was working at a no longer existing computer company called Compaq and was part of the first wave of direct-to-consumer. So he was part of the team that was figuring out how to educate people on how to use computers in their households, right? And it sounds silly today because we literally cannot live without our computational devices, but there was a moment in which there was education. He was talking about how they would teach computer classes in like Best Buy and all these stores. And we don't have that paradigm today. So we're just like AI and throw it out into the world. And then we're all going to sit and discuss the future of work. But I don't see where we are trying to do that upskilling. And I think because this technology is sold as being so fancy and highbrow and magical, we're not thinking of, frankly, very boring and pragmatic use cases for it. Like there should be an AI for accounting course and accountants should be taught how to use the AI systems that maybe some startup is making. Why not, right? Because they can then make smart decisions for themselves rather than have that be imposed on them when some major corporation decides they want to, quote, automate accounting. Because I'll tell you exactly how that story goes. Some major corporation decides they want to automate accounting. They fire a bunch of people who do this job, and then they realize the AI just actually didn't do it as well as the people did. And then they have to try to cover their losses, fix their messes, and bring people back in. But wouldn't the smarter way be to actually provide the skill set to people in a wide range of professions? So rather than jumping from no technology to a world of UBI, which I think a lot of people do, let's examine what the history of technology has taught us, which is that we land somewhere in the middle. We had the same automation 4-hour work week conversation with the first industrial revolution. There's so much literature coming out of the first industrial revolution that was specifically about, that's actually where we get the idea of a 4-hour work day, by the way, or work week. It was literally somebody was talking about it, how no one's going to have to work anymore and how are we going to get money and the state will just pay us. And literally none of that happened. If anything, we all work more than we did before. So history has shown us that has never happened before. And I don't think this technology is particularly exceptional that it will be the first time that that happens. But what we may get are a wide range of people who do not have the skills to be competitive in the workforce. And that is a different conversation than all jobs are automated.
I had a couple of experiences the last couple of days that have been quite interesting when it comes to the adaption of technology. Here we are in Austin here, and we do see all those autonomous cars driving around. Waymo is providing cars for Uber, so you can book an Uber, and if you're kind of lucky or not, depends on the perspective, you'll get a Waymo, and you'll experience a fully automated autonomous ride. I had that yesterday with like a 45 minutes ride from downtown to the north of the city. And it was my first fully autonomous ride. Mm-hmm. Before that, I had a couple of experiences on some training centers or something like that, where it was like a closed environment. But that was the first out in the wild, more or less. And we are here with a whole travel group of like 15 to 20 people. And some of us all also had a ride with that autonomous car. But we talked a lot also there. We talked a lot about this fascinating future where we will all have like autonomous cars. And then all of a sudden, we are sitting in a car like that and it fascinates us for like 5 minutes. And then we are like, okay, feels like normal and it's not strange anymore, or it doesn't really excite us anymore. Is that something, like, is technology just happening way too fast because we today are sitting in an autonomous car and tomorrow ChatGPT is able to do something new we didn't expect before, and it's like the speed of evolution with autonomous and artificial intelligence technologies is so fast that we are just not like able to keep track. Also then again with ethics and how we regulate all that stuff.
Well, autonomous vehicles actually is the best example to use about how technology doesn't happen overnight. Some of the earliest concept cars of autonomous vehicles comes from the 2000s. And it's interesting because it's also an interesting case study in liability. So if you look at the earliest autonomous cars that were built, some of them were by like Honda, the concept cars they would have at the shows. The way they looked was like a little pod, and you'd have these seats that faced each other. And that's actually really important. Why do the seats face each other? Because there is no steering wheel, there is no brake, there is no, right? Because it was expected this would be fully autonomous, as in there is no driver, right? And this is important for a reason. So that was 20 years ago. Now we are 20 years later, and we have cars that take years to operate in one city. So to be clear, it's not like you can take this Waymo that you took in Austin and put it in the middle of Houston where I live and it would operate. It wouldn't. It would crash into things like in 30 seconds, right? So it's fascinating to me that we consider this an amazing leap in technology when this vehicle took years to do what a 16-year-old can be taught in about like 3 weeks, right? So you take a child, a human child who has never driven a vehicle, and you stick them in a car and you give them instruction for 3 weeks, and that kid can do that same ride. And you can take that kid and put them in Houston, and they can also get from Houston downtown to uptown, right? So that level of transferability does not yet exist. It takes years and years of data. And frankly, Waymo is like limping along, but all of the other autonomous vehicle companies have folded because they could not solve this problem, the scalability problem. They need, again, massive amounts of data, right? They need to train for many, many years to work on hyper-localized examples. So it's truly not, and these were concepts that started, again, in the mid-2000s. So we've taken 20 years to get to a point where the technology limps along. So it's like, to me, it's not this amazing story of automation, actually. It is a more realistic, by the way, story of automation. So in those 20 years, we actually have had time to conceptually get used to the idea, to physically get used to the idea, and hopefully in a regulatory perspective, get used to the idea. Unfortunately, from the regulatory perspective, it's not gone well, right? So we've had already examples with Tesla, with Uber, of self-driving cars causing accidents. And what they have done is they push the liability on the quote unquote driver. So just so you know, when you get into these vehicles, well, the Waymo doesn't count because it's through Uber. But if you were to own an autonomous vehicle, what any of these car companies call autonomous, even though they're not autonomous, you are liable. So if that car gets into an accident, you cannot say, oh, but it's autonomous. Doesn't matter. Because interestingly, even though they are selling you this story of automation, they are selling legally the story of, oh, you're the driver, a human's the driver. So now we've gone from this world we were sold of these concept cars where the seats faced each other because there was no human driver to, oh, I guess we got to worry about who's liable. And companies are like, it can't be us. So if you read the fine print with any of these so-called autonomous vehicles, you, the human, have to be sitting in the driver's seat with your hands on the wheel and your foot on the brake in case something happens. So if we think about that story, where was the benefit to any of us? So you still have to have all the stress a driver has, but you actually have less control over how the vehicle is moving, and yet you have all the responsibility. So that story to me does not sound like one in which I benefited from automation. It sounds like they're just going to sell me a bunch of overpriced stuff and it will maybe work and maybe not work. But when it doesn't work, it's my fault, right? So that's what I'm concerned about. We should have had this concept car that was shown to us on car shows in 2005. But the reason we have the cars constructed the way we do today is a liability question. So to get to that world in which we're amazed by all the automation and like everybody has an autonomous vehicle, right? We have to make a way, a path forward in which all the liability doesn't fall on you and me.
I do remember a panel discussion on our very own 48 Ford Festival 10 years ago in Munich about the future of mobility and autonomous driving. And I brought up the question, if we are in a situation with a fully autonomous car where the driver is not liable, so future vision, if there are three options, like killing the driver by running the car into
a wall,
having a little child on the street playing, running that one over, or an elderly man on the pathway walking and killing that one. So these three options, what is the car choosing?
And so I just want to be clear, the car doesn't choose. The car never chooses. No, the car doesn't choose. The car is not alive. The programmers who made the software make some sort. And this is the problem with the decision being shoved up the pipeline to people who are not physically in that position, because what's going to happen is you get a room of engineers who treat this like an intellectual problem, discussing things like, well, the old man is old, so he should just die because we shouldn't let a young person with so much life potential. And well, the driver is a monetizable asset, right? And then the lawyer sitting in that panel is going to say, well, where's the most liability here? Because that old person may actually have a lot of assets and wealth and connections by which they can sue. But on the other end, people are very sympathetic to children dying. So yeah, maybe it should be. The minute we intellectualize a problem like that, we are losing humanity. And we did not do it because a machine made a decision. We did it because we have removed ourselves from the decision-making responsibility, because we have abstracted human life into an idea we argue about. And that, to me, is really important. So I gave this talk years ago called moral outsourcing was the phrase I coined. And it's exactly these kinds of intellectual exercises that engineers get to put into actual technologies that remove them, right? So moral outsourcing is, we're going to say the car is making the decision, right? Because we're outsourcing the morality of the decision on a technical object, but actually the human being made that decision. So this happened with an Uber self-driving car, right? So it was an Uber self-driving car. It was a prototype car. So there was a woman behind the wheel who was supposed to be monitoring, and it hit and killed a woman who was crossing the street. And apparently, so there were a couple of reasons why the car hit the woman. She was not crossing at a crosswalk. So it did not, you know, its cameras did not pick up a crosswalk. And number two, I think because of the way the lighting was calibrated, like, so you as an engineer, you sort of pick how sensitive it will be to light. It didn't see her, essentially, right? So these are design and calibration decisions that were made. Guess where the liability falls? The woman who was the driver. So the engineers who indirectly or directly, however you want to put it, led to the death of this woman get to decide intellectually how to treat this problem as if it's a computational abstraction rather than a human being's life. And the person who is paid probably minimum wage to sit behind that car is the person who goes to prison. And like, that's the paradigm I am deeply concerned about. And you know, the first place you actually started to see this stuff was in the military. As we started to roll out, and I specifically remember this because it's something that's like burned into one of my core memories. I think it was around like 2009. There was this video, this was during the war in Afghanistan, right? Of this young soldier, and he had just piloted a drone that, you know, killed somebody, right? This is like, whatever, right? Because now this is totally normal, right? Now it's like, yeah, drone-based operations, whatever. Now we're unmanned drones, right? Constantly being discussed. And it wasn't that. It was actually that when he did it, they were all cheering in the room. And like, yeah, I get it. That person's an enemy combatant. You're supposed to not like him. But to cheer at the loss of human life that you caused, really, it just struck me. And also the fact that this man was so young. He was a child. So he's probably like 20, 21 years old, cheering because he halfway across the world killed somebody. But I can tell you from knowing people who were actually in the military, who were in the first Iraq war, for example, right? None of them cheered when they killed somebody because they had to actually look at somebody and kill them. And like, this is getting, you know, very deep and heavy, but this is the thing, like a lot of this technology allows us to abstract ourselves from what the world really is and the impact of our decisions, because we can sit in nice air-conditioned rooms and intellectualize issues that then on the ground lead to somebody dying. But I never have to be there when somebody dies. I can be this 21-year-old soldier sitting in a room with my buddies, and it looks like a video game that I'm playing, even though halfway across the world, you've killed someone's father. But you're never going to see that, and you're never going to feel that. And all of his friends are high-fiving him.
So in the end, we if we just look at the last 10 years, we built all those new technologies, made a lot of technological progress, but kind of missed out on the ethics and liability discussion in the end, like in whatever area of AI?
And largely, yes. I think the only places where we're seeing any sort of protections are ones in which they already existed, right? So healthcare, finance, right? We have some sort of protections, and those are the places where it's actually enforceable. You can actually say you can't just take someone's medical information and then decide that you can't give them a job because now you found out they have cancer, right? Because by the way, these are the things that would probably happen if we didn't have data protections for these kinds of things, right? Or actually what you're most likely to see happen, which is, you know, if medical records were not privileged information, people would find out that someone was having a baby, for example, and they're pregnant this information would be sold. And they would be either denied opportunities or marketed other things based on this personal information about themselves, right? So the places where we have seen limitations are ones in which we have already created protections.
Maybe one last more or less philosophical question. If we look at capitalism, how it is today, I do have the feeling that the capitalist interest in the end will always kind of have a higher priority than the ethics argument in the long run, because there's always someone who's saying, yeah, but the others are doing it. We also need to do it because otherwise we are going to lose economically. Do you think we need to define that whole capitalistic system in a different way for, in the end, to be able to deal with that for the common good?
So, okay, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is, I think about the problem you're posing in different ways. One is actually, I think capitalism encourages us to think selfishly and work selfishly in the short term to long-term detriment. So actually, I don't think it's that capitalism wins in the long run. Capitalism actually wins in the short term. And then in the long run, they're like, oh crap, I guess we don't have drinkable water anymore. You know, so it's, but because, and like, this is going towards like, what does it look like to reimagine it? And I'm not the first person to say this by any means. There have been CEOs of companies, for example, like the CEO of Panera, left Panera to really think through this problem. And what he argued when he built the sandwich company was that he wanted to make a company that made it affordable for people to have healthy food. And the bigger and bigger and bigger the company got, the more pressure he got to sell soda, for example, because soda is a huge, like they pay pennies, less than a cent to make a giant thing of soda that you can sell for $3, right? But Panera sold juice and iced tea, which is not as profitable, right? So as those pressures kept mounting, he's like, well, there's something very broken here. I should be able to just build this company and build it big and not have to sell people junk, right? And so I'm not the first person to say this, but there is something about how short-term revenue is prioritized. So one of the reasons we see so many tech companies constantly pushing out garbage products is they have to show what's known as the hockey puck. They have to constantly be showing growth, even if it actually doesn't make sense anymore. So like Facebook is a really great example. Most of the world actually has Facebook. Like most of the digitized world has it. How are they supposed to constantly show growth? There are literally not enough people. And yet they have to. And that's why they have to make new products and new ways of accessing them so they can say, well, growth is here and growth is there. But that's an arbitrary construct that actually doesn't make sense, right? So what might it look like for investors, like shareholders, capitalists, to actually think about long-term gain, which, by the way, isn't at odds with, you know, income and revenue. It's just at odds with short-term income and revenue. And the third thing is, maybe we should just also be more clear that companies are not here to fix our lives. Companies are here to make money. And we can be like, that's cool. That's what they're there for. But then who is here to fix our lives? Is it government? Is it civil society? If so, then let's empower those organizations to do it, right? So if we say corporations are here to just make money and we're okay with that, then what is the counterbalance? Because maybe we don't have to reform capitalism. It's that we have to create a better counterbalance to it.
And then in the end, we will come to a discussion. What is the human going to do if we end up in a world where companies are only there to make money and maybe at some point in time get completely automated and there will always be a couple of humans, but in the end, we will see companies that are running fully automated and are producing fully automated and are just earning money, right?
Well, if we're going to talk fantastical futures, then we can imagine a Star Trek future, right? So there's this book called Trekonomics, which is about the economics of Star Trek. And actually the fundamental economic unit of Star Trek is actually the easy reproducibility of goods. So if you watch Star Trek, the replicator, right? So the invention of the replicator meant that there was no scarcity. There was a zero scarcity world. If I wanted a Louis Vuitton bag, I can just be like, replicator, make me a Louis Vuitton bag, and it will just make me one. So money is useless. Currency is useless because those things exist because of scarcity. And then you have to think about what does redistribution start to look like? And that to me is a more fascinating and interesting world because again, like money is an arbitrary construct that we have built because scarcity exists. And we needed to figure out how, you know, you have three donkeys and I have five apples and like you want apples and I want a donkey. And how are we going to sort this out? Right. So how do we monetize the value of an apple and the value of a donkey? Because if I were like, here, I'll trade you one apple for one of your donkeys, you'd be like, that doesn't sound like a good deal. And I'm like, well, why? Right. That's where this idea comes from. But again, in a world in which I can just go replicate a donkey and you can go replicate apples, we don't need to have that interaction. So it's a very fascinating book. I've kind of oversimplified the narrative of it, but it talks about what a post-scarcity world looks like. And to be clear, like that post-scarcity world will not be ushered in by capitalists, right? Because capitalists, their mission is to make money. That's what they are there for. And, you know, I was at Twitter. The term fiduciary duty really became burned into our heads because while we can and did make every single argument, all of which has proven to be true, of why Elon Musk should not buy Twitter, it didn't matter at the end of the day because Twitter was a for-profit company and he offered a significant amount more than it was worth. So according to the board, they were under their fiduciary responsibility to take that deal, even if we all knew and agreed that that deal would lead to democratic discord. The world we are living in today, it's not that when Twitter was sold, we were unaware, right? The board was aware of what was going to happen. They literally, according to them, couldn't do anything about it because it was their fiduciary responsibility to do so. So we already have that world.
And I'm really looking forward to continue that discussion about that world in the future at some other stage or occasion with you. Thank you so much for taking the time and joining me here.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.